being replaced and so on, so you have a kind of a running perpetual record of these committees, which has been a big operation. Now, I got involved in it in part because the Chancellor appoints a lot of committees that are basically not appointed by his selection, but by his authority. That is, if you're talking about the Atlas of Wisconsin committee, why, you go to the people on that committee and want to know who they want on their committee. And I'd say the Chancellor has never really cared. He never really questioned who goes on there. And certainly if there's no problems, why, basically, I'm saying that the process of getting these committees together involves talking to a lot of people and getting the lists of names. Now, I always made a practice in talking with the Chancellor going through the committee lists, and first you find out whether these are committees in which he has a particular interest or a particular feeling. There are some committees that, as we would say, give him trouble, and committees that have done something conspicuously bad, sometimes conspicuously good, in which he takes kind of a personal interest, but lots of them are not. And so over a period of time, I function mainly to get together lists of names, sometimes almost without asking the Chancellor about it, and sometimes with him participating quite a lot. And then we write the letters, appoint them, and then we keep the records. Now it becomes a big continuing sort of problem.
Yeah, I can certainly see where it would.
Now, then I discovered almost at once that the Secretary of the Faculty has historically become quite a place for information. If you don't know where to go, what to do, don't know what the rules are, something, you call the Office of the Secretary of the Faculty. So I ended up, I suppose, I don't know what percent of my time, but a great deal of my time was spent on the telephone, people calling in on a whole great variety of questions. And I always liked this as a job. I mean, I thought it was interesting. For one thing, you have to find out what the rules are and be prepared to locate them again when somebody asks you and recite them and so on. But people bring a lot of problems to you that you never heard of. And so in a way, this kind of being the clearinghouse, mainly for faculty or for questions about the faculty, but not altogether, this has been one of the important functions we've had, and one of the interesting ones. Well, now, what I'm saying, of course, is the official functions of the Secretary of the Faculty are fairly small, a core of duties that are not, to be honest with you, they're not particularly interesting. I mean, who likes to go and sit and take minutes and write up minutes for things? The Secretary, unfortunately, has to go to all the meetings, and he has to sit through all the discussions, and he has to sit there with his mouth shut, which always is very difficult for me, because sometimes you know more about it than the people who are doing all the talking, you see. And you kind of feel as though your role as a mute in this process isn't a lot of fun. But this little core of official duties, with a lot of other things attached to it, becomes kind of a large and diverse and interesting occupation. And one of the things that we probably ought to talk about before we get through here is a change. In recent times, and I'd say in the past year, many of these functions have been stripped off the Office of the Secretary of the Faculty, leaving what I don't think is a very interesting or a full-time job for anybody in no field. So this is one of the reasons that I have that I've gotten out of it. There just isn't that kind of a job left anymore. Now, before we drop this subject I'm talking about, which is basically the role of the Office of the Secretary, there's another part, and this is as a kind of, I'm speaking of the way that Ed Young and I both envisioned this at the time I became Secretary. This is somebody who acts as a kind of an administrative executive, I'd probably be better, an executive secretary for the university committee. Not as a member of the university committee, but somebody who works very closely with the university committee on the kinds of things the university committee does. I think this is very important, and since I'll dwell on it, because there's been a marked change in this just recently. But the university committee, she has no continuity. People are elected. It's a six-man committee, and two people are elected every year to three-year terms. A constant turnover. There's nobody been on there for... Well, actually, nobody's ever been on there for more than 2 years. I mean, by the end of the third year, of course, you made 3 years. But I mean, it's a constant turnover, and they have there's no real continuity in the sense that nobody knows what was done 4 years ago or anything like that.
That's good or bad?
Bad. Because a committee gets in a room, they get tossed a question, and unless they have some access to what has been done before, they go through the business of hashing over the issues, the pros and cons, and making a decision. And it may be quite a departure from what we've had as an established policy, and they don't even know it. Now, why don't they check up? Well, they get a lot of big problems. And they don't have time, and the part of a committee can sometimes get out of the habit of asking anybody else. You know, I mean, if you are the committee that makes a lot of big decisions and so on, why, you tend to view any kind of a problem people bring to you as something new, and you solve it your own way. And of course, what that means is that you go. It's a roller coaster in the kinds of policies that you come out with, and you can change them completely without even knowing it. Well, now, it's that kind of a function that the secretary of the faculty ought to fill. I think, now they don't do it or have only done it in part, but when something comes up, a new question comes up, somebody ought to ask, has this question ever come up before, and where's the files, and what are the things that have been said about it?
Seems so like it's pretty obvious.
Well, it does, except that in the past couple of years, some very strange things have happened. I get calls, an agenda will come out. I'll get calls from people who have worked in these areas before. I remember one call was from a gal who'd been the secretary of the faculty for the center system, and for she'd been on a university faculty council secretary of faculty lists and one thing or another, just breaking into gales of laughter. Said, well, here are two items on the thing. She said, well, we've spent years getting rid of that. Now, why does this come up again? Why does the university committee bring it up? Well, the reason the university committee brought it up was that they didn't think to ask anybody whether this had ever come up before. And they come up and been disposed of, you see. They make some, you can make some quite serious, I think, errors by this kind of thing. Well, this is one of the functions of the secretary that has in the past been quite an important role in the whole conduct of faculty government. Now, he also handles a lot of the mechanics of these things. You see, we get a committee report. Technically, the university committee doesn't always recognize this, but technically a committee of the faculty reports to the faculty. They don't report to the university committee. They report to the faculty. They prepare a report, recommendations. Well, everybody has his own idea how to set these things up. Well, somebody ought to get to, when this report comes in, somebody ought to say, now it is our accepted practice for parliamentary reasons to have all of the recommendations listed at the end of the report and numbered and separately identified as recommendations. This particular reason is that, I mean, you can have a report of 20 pages and the faculty should never be asked to approve that kind of a report. That means approving every word in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't necessarily approve of the guy's arguments or the committee's arguments or their lines of thinking or the way they present certain problems. What you really want to pass judgment on, yes or no, are these things listed as recommendations. To appoint a committee, to charge a committee to do such and so, you see,
mm-hmm.
on the specifics. Well, our system used to be one in which these reports were to be in a form that's basically in a form that's acceptable to the secretary of the faculty as being in a So these matters that went on the agenda were in a form suitable for expeditious treatment by the Senate, proper amount of information provided so it's clear and all that kind of stuff. Well, a lot of this is, well, it's something more than strictly clerical, but it's a separate function. Somebody looks this over and sees that these things are all in order. And this is one of the things the Secretary was supposed to do. Never expected to be a member of the committee, but always should know what the committee was working on. At one time we talked about a secretary who would make some studies, you know, kind of the staff studies of a particular situation as a kind of a prerequisite, rather than having the committee do it themselves. Now these were things that that Ed Young and I envisioned, and they've sort of been phased out for various reasons, I suppose. But there are major changes in the role of the secretary. And I think they could be important. I think they can be missed, except that they're no longer performed by that office.
Do you want to go into the hows and whys of their being phased out?
Well, I have a kind of a one of these answers that is more subjective than anything else. I think a committee tends to take itself pretty seriously, and this is one of the things that happens to everybody who becomes a member of the all-powerful and influential university committee. You begin to think your judgment on this is better. I mean, it may not be correct, it may not be all there is to be asked, but it's as good as anybody. So you don't really feel an awful great deal, you don't feel a great urge to go out and consult other people on a lot of these things. We have had, and I'm speaking of myself too, you see, because I've been through all this sort of thing. You tend to do things and you don't really ask around. You, under pressure of time or something like that, you go ahead and you handle these things yourself. You don't get accustomed to asking other people. Now, more important probably is the is the suspicion with which faculty people view an administrator. This was something that shocked me in some ways. You see, I had gone through the university committee, and I was chairman of the university committee, and I was asked to speak to the Rotary about as a head of a powerful university committee and things like that, representing the faculty. And I became secretary of the faculty, and it took about 24 hours before I was to some extent identified with administration and not with the faculty.
Just like that?
Pretty nearly like that. Now there has been a good deal more of that in recent years. I think in connection with the all the years of strife and contention and so on, everybody likes to try to identify somebody else, some outsider that's really responsible for our problems. We've had quite an active bunch of faculty people who, as a matter of course, denounce the administration, and with some justification, you see. I mean, the administration covers everybody other than the faculty. And the push for collective bargaining for the faculty, organization of the faculty separate from the traditional one, some of those things, they've all tended to draw a line between the administration and the faculty, and to put them in separate camps. We've continued this thing, and the organization of this Profs Incorporated is an example of this, but they tended to draw apart and be quite jealous of their own prerogatives. I would like to get on this subject a little bit later with some more specific things, but one of the reasons I think is that the office to some extent has disappointed me of the role of the secretary has been one that you should have foreseen. I should have foreseen. I think we've just been growing apart, the faculty and the administration. And I was not very realistic. I guess I was thinking that if I was chairman of the university committee 1 year, why I would be able to engage them as equals the following year, you see, because we were all part of the same system. But some of those things were changed. But that, I think, is another subject that we should take up a little bit later. Last time, I said something about the search and screen committee, and it occurs to me that was something I wanted to add to that. You remember I said that the committee doing the search and screen job for the chancellor when Ed Young was picked originally came up with a panel of names that didn't include Ed Young's name. And at that point, or soon after, at an interval afterwards, President Harrington then asked the committee to provide him with more names, and we came up with Ed Young's name and another name. And he appointed Ed Young. Well, we knew, from at least it was general belief, that Fred Harrington wanted to appoint Ed Young in the first place. And I mean, this was the newspaper speculation and the common talk and all that sort of thing. And I always thought that raised kind of an interesting point here. Now, I firmly believe that the president has to appoint the person he wants as a chancellor, not somebody else. I think the president has to be able to pick his number one man, who is actually the man who's going to carry out the president's policies in the various universities around in our system now. And I don't believe that the president should be denied the right to put up the man he wants to. And that means that the search and screen committee really has two separate and somewhat contradictory functions here, it seems to me. One of them is to pick a panel of names of the people who are best qualified in the judgment of the committee, and let somebody make a choice from that. But another function is probably to pass on the qualifications of the person, of certain selected persons that are the more likely candidates. I mean, as a practical matter, I think that a president should be able to go to a search and screen committee and say, "Now look, fellas, does my candidate meet your requirements?" You see, don't tell me how many other people you think are better than he is or anything like that. I want to know, is this man, yes or no, qualified to be chancellor? And I think the search and screen committee has to answer that. Now, and one of the reasons that I think this is relevant now is that it seems to me the current search and screen committee is determined to pick the people they think should be chosen as chancellor, and to eliminate ones who may be qualified and who, for some reason or other, the committee doesn't like so well. Now, I don't know what the situation is, since it's all rumor at this point. Of course, we don't know who Ed Young is going to appoint as our next chancellor, but I never understood, for instance, why Dave Cronin, who's quite an obvious candidate for this, should have been left off the list.
Well, he was there in the very beginning, it was rumored.
Oh, yeah, sure. I think everybody you can think of was on that original 93 or whatever names, you know, and so on. But why they refused to put him on, why they stopped short with four names, if they thought this was Dave was a likely candidate for this kind of a position, why they refused to put him on, I don't know. I think they were trying to direct the chancellor's choice, which I don't really think is a function of the committee. You might like to know, part of the record here, who the people were we did nominate for this position.
Yes, I would.
Hold on just a minute here. We came up with seven names originally on the 8th of August, and the names were Bob Clodius, who, of course, former vice president of the system, and Fred Harrington's number one man, Leon Epstein, Roger Hines, who was then chancellor of Berkeley, and a man named Horning, who is a director of the Office of Science and Technology, and I think chairman, or maybe at least a member of the president's Science Advisory Commission and things of that sort. A man, I don't know whether he had any university administrative experience or not, but he had very high scientific qualifications. Bri Curl was one, and Bob Parks, who was then, I think he had already become president of Iowa State University, and Bob Marshall, who was then an associate dean of the College of Engineering. Then we added subsequently, when asked to do so, two more names, one of them being Ed Youngs and the other one being Byron Bird, who's a distinguished professor of chem engineering, I think it is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So those are the names that came up.
Now, could you tell me why Young wasn't on that initially?
Well, that's kind of murky, but I see from some of my notes, since I've looked over since the last time, that the things that were held against him were mentioned. I guess I would say, really, that the thing that was held against him mostly was that he was a front runner of Fred Harrington's candidate. I mean, this kind of gives you a sort of an initial sort of a doubt against these people. He was said to be a poor speaker, which I suppose is so. In the sense that he speaks hesitantly, very carefully. His words are very carefully chosen, and I've had occasion to go back over some of these things, and I know when he says something, it's exactly what the way he wants to say it. It sounds hesitant. It's not a very fluent one. It was said he was not very good at presiding at over faculty meetings and things like that. Well, that is absolutely wrong, because he was very accomplished at that sort of thing. In his own style, he did just a superlative job of running these things. Another comment, it said that he let someone else answer the questions. Well, that is true. As I have said, he doesn't come out very strongly or definitely in answer to questions. I mean, you ask him, you can discuss things with him, but you're never quite sure what his reaction is. So that is probably true. Says he's not decisive. Well, as I mentioned, one of the former chairman, departmental chairman, said, well, you're going to discuss a problem with him and you come away not knowing how he stands, which is probably true. This is one of his styles. And then somebody said he was a loser. And I never quite understood that. They said he was a failure as a dean, and he had to leave and become a president of the main university, and then he had to leave there and come back and as a vice president. Well, I guess I thought all of these things were improvements in his situation, and not as a loser, but at least he had, I guess it's true that he hadn't stayed with any particular assignment for all of his life, and so on, whatever that means. But that's all I don't know. It never really made very much sense to me, but the vote was pretty consistent on him. He was, in the first prescreening, he was one of the marginal candidates, and then on the first solid vote we took, there was a vote of 2-4 and 7 against, and that didn't change until we finally came around some time later and picked him and Bob Bird, both of who had about the same kind of a vote to begin with, picked them as candidates.
These were the final two.
These were the final two that Fred Harrington asked us for. Well, now, I don't know what you would like to pick up here, Donna, but it seems to me that much of the theme of this is a change in the nature of faculty government, and what I think of as a deterioration of the role of the faculty at Wisconsin. I suppose I'm in a, being an age and having had the job that I've had and so on, maybe I'm prone to think that things are going to pot, but it has seemed to me that the role of the faculty has diminished considerably from what it was. Now, I have had occasion to talk to quite a number of secretaries of the faculty at Big Ten. We have had a couple of meetings, for instance. And over the years, you do talk about other institutions, and it does seem to me that from all the evidence I have, the faculty had a great deal more power and authority and a much larger role at Wisconsin than in any other place I know of. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't others, but I don't know of any more. And it's a faculty power that has certain, I suppose, specific manifestations, and then a lot of it just in the kind of the in the way people feel about the role of the faculty.
Well, it has been true that they've not only had a role, but they've prided themselves on this.
We've written into our regulations, for instance, the authority of a departmental faculty. That's the same faculty, but at the departmental level, our faculty has always, to my knowledge, has always had the power to decide who is to be hired, who is to be promoted, where the merit money increase went, and so on. Now that's a pretty important right of authority there, decision in our own departmental faculty. It was, of course, any recommendations of the departmental faculty then was subject to review and possible non-approval by the dean and the higher levels, but the faculty, the departmental faculty, had the initial right of making the recommendations. And the dean did not jump in the picture and say, well, now I think you ought to hire so-and-so, because the department is the one who decided that sort of thing. And that's very important. Most deans are very reluctant to override the recommendations of a department. I think that's true now, but there have been a few cases in which they did, but for the most part, you take the departmental recommendations and you live with them. And nobody else makes these recommendations. Nobody puts a man in a department without the consent of that departmental faculty. There may be some pressure if you bring in a president and you want to find a departmental home for him, you may make a number of suggestions, but that is basically a right of the faculty to decide, and they've been very jealous about this. Another thing that has been a source of faculty power is the fact that all of the major administrative people have come from the faculty. They've been chosen from the faculty. They assume the position. I guess I'm thinking here of at the level of the dean, chancellor, and that sort of a position, and some of the vice chancellors. They come from the faculty. They know these things from the viewpoint of the faculty, and they, in their dealings as chancellors and deans, they deal with their former colleagues who are still members of the faculty. And more to the point, they're going to go back to the faculty, because our major administrative positions, the age of retirement is 65, and the age of retirement from the faculty is 70. And normally, a man is a dean for a while, and then he expects to go back to the faculty. There's just that built-in faculty bias in the administrative level. Now, another thing very difficult to put in specific terms is the fact that the faculty has always been very vocal, very much interested in everything that went on in the university, not at all inhibited on what it chose to pass judgment on. And that is, we have, whether you call it legislation or not, the faculty meetings would get together and they'd pass a resolution on anything they thought they ought to pass a resolution on. Then these resolutions went to the regents, and the regents, for the most part, adopted them. At least in very, very, the regents have always been very reluctant to override anything on which the faculty had taken a position, and more than that, they've been quite reluctant to set policy and make decisions without asking the faculty on matters where they quite clearly in interest of the faculty. Now, this latter part never was very well reflected in any legislation. It came up, I think, first to my knowledge, when we had some of the disorders, and when Gene Cameron, for instance, went down as the chairman of the university committee, went down to meet with a legislative investigation committee, to look into these disorders. And he talked about what the faculty was doing, the way the faculty feels, and how this decides, how this is a decisive factor. And legislators asked him, what kind of right does the faculty have to interfere here? Well, the fact is, there was nothing in the legislation. The decisions were made by the regents, but the regents, through tradition and their were in the habit of asking the faculty how to make these decisions. So there was the gap between anything that is printed in the legislative sense and what the faculty actually did in the way of exercise power was very considerable.
I think there are quite clearly some things in the academic area, like what kinds of courses shall be taught and so on, that are generally conceded to be in the interest of, among the responsibilities of the faculty to decide. But many of these other things weren't. Maybe I can give you an example of, we have had a document called the Laws and Regulations of the University.
I'm familiar with it.
And this is one that consists of a number of chapters and it covers a great many things to do with the university. A great deal of it came directly from the faculty. These were legislation that was written by faculty committees or by the faculty in an amendment and that sort of thing, adopted by the faculty, went on to the regents, then the regents would adopt it or approve it or something, and then publish it as laws and regulations of the university. Well, actually, it was directly from the faculty. But it was published as laws and regulations of the university, published under the clear legislative authority of the regents. And there's nothing that said the faculty is a party that makes these decisions, except that what their decisions were ones that were accepted by the regents. Well, this is a murky area, and as a matter of fact, what we've come up against in more recent years, beginning about 1973, the University Committee launched on a revision of these laws and regulations. They badly needed revision because many changes had taken place and got behind in keeping them up to date, even in the terminology and things like that. But this revision coming out of the university committee was called Faculty Rules and Regulations, and this was something that the university committee envisioned as being adopted and passed by the faculty and then issued as faculty rules. And they took many parts out of this old laws and regulations of the university published under the authority of the regent. And it did raise for the first time a question that we had sought very carefully to avoid. Many previous this question has come up over the years, and most previous university committees were most anxious to avoid raising the question of just how far does the legislative authority of the faculty go. I'll give you an example. Here we have a section in there that says the chairman of a department in the present rules, and it has been this way over the years, the chairman of an academic department is appointed by the dean. So you see, he's a member of the administration, an administrative appointment. However, there is an advisory vote possible. There is provision for an advisory vote by the members of the department to the dean to suggest who they think should be the departmental chairman. And for the most part, the dean will accept this advisory vote as a kind of a popular referendum, and he's guided by it pretty much.
This is what I've understood.
There are cases when they don't. Now, a department can get badly divided, and they can be having a lot of troubles, and then the dean will exercise his superior authority, and there's no question that he's got the authority, at least under our present organization. He has the authority to appoint a person called a chairman. Now, this person is a chairman. He's not a head or director or anything like that. He's a chairman. What he does is preside, and the decisions, you see, in theory are made by the departmental faculty, and all he does is transmit them to the dean. Well, now, the legislation setting this thing up, you see, if you incorporate it as faculty rules and regulations, and this is the way it's been done in the past and the way that's been agreed on, you can't really see anything terribly wrong about that. So the faculty rules say, well, the dean appoints, but the faculty has a right to this preferential vote on the ballot on the choice of a chairman. But the right to legislate also implies a right to amend and to repeal and to change the legislature, to legislate other ways, you see. So if you just automatically say that this is within the authority of the faculty to legislate on this kind of a point, you're saying, really, that the faculty also has a right to decide at some future time that they don't like it this way. What they want is the department will elect the dean. The department will elect its own chairman. Instead of a preferential ballot, you'll elect them. And I know that this is a common reaction among faculty people to think, well, we pick a chairman here, and what's the dean doing missing in there? Well, what this would do, if you conceded this to be the authority of the faculty on a point like this, why then you were saying that the faculty makes this decision and the administration doesn't have a role in it. And that's something we don't think you'd want to concede right at the time. Well, this question never came up, because the faculty would make a lot of rules, and they would debate and frame resolutions and write legislation, and they transmit it to the regents, and the regents would generally adopt it. And the regents would have also, in the old laws and regulations, they'd have other parts that came out of administration. And the real source of where these different chapters and that laws and regulations volume came was sort of irrelevant, but it was not known, it was not documented in the laws and regulations. Only by going back through the legislative history do you know whether this came out of the chancellor's office or whether it came out of a faculty meeting, you see. Because it's all published under the right of the regents. Nobody ever questioned the authority of the regents to legislate, but the question of where the faculty legislative authority began and ended never was settled. In recent years, to come down hard on that raises a question that we wanted to leave undecided, and because I think you can only conclude that in the present atmosphere, by the time you get everybody to agree what the legislative role of the faculty is, it'll be very much diminished from anything that we had in the past, the effective role that we had. Well, we always have had, and we still have, I think, a very considerable measure of faculty power, although I think it has been eroded. I think actually it's been eroded from several different viewpoints. I would kind of like to mention each one of them. Merger, of course, has been one of the factors we have to talk about.
Yes.
Another one that has to be talked about, I think, is the development of faculty senate and all that that implies. Now, a good many people wouldn't consider this as one of the factors that would diminish the role of the faculty, but I think I see that it does, and I'd like to make some comments on that. Then there are some things that the faculty itself has done, and that the university committees have done over the years that I think, in a sense, have tended to diminish the role of the faculty. So I'd like to cover all those points a little bit.
Fine.
The merger. We formerly had what we all had grown up to know as the University of Wisconsin, and it had a board of regents, all of whom were directly concerned. It was, by modern standards, it was a small board of regents, and they were all concerned with that one university, our university. Now, to make that university only a part of a larger system, and to have a lot of University of Wisconsin's, with a board of regents that is accustomed to representing 13 others, I guess it is, some such number when we get through counting them all. This has put our university in a different position altogether. Merger, whatever its merits are concerned, has had a couple of effects. One, it has had the equalizing effect. Way back when merger was being talked about, I recall Governor Pat Lucey showing up at a faculty meeting. He's always been never afraid to talk to people, so he came out to this faculty meeting, a special faculty meeting, and he announced what he was thinking about in terms of merger and what it meant. And he said that any parent in Wisconsin wants to send their children to a university ought to get the same kind of education no matter where they go. They ought to have equally good people, you see, one place or another. And I think he used the example of teaching of French. Someone who teaches introductory French ought to be as good in one place as another, and I think he even mentioned salary in this connection. Well, this is a kind of concept of equal treatment for everybody in the whole university system. And of course, that makes a great deal of difference to an institution like ours, where we were far above everybody else. What you do is get equal treatment by bringing up the people below and knocking down the ones above, relatively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been true of faculty government. We had a very pronounced and active faculty, very, very potent force in the whole governance of the university at this institution, but some of the other institutions, former state teachers colleges and so on, I think they didn't even have any faculty organization. As far as I recall it, in some cases they didn't have a faculty organization at all, let alone one that's effective. And when the regents, now a large board, contemplates rules for the university that are going to apply to all of these institutions, they have to think in terms of rules that are going to apply uniformly. And what they do, I think what they've done is greatly expand the authority of faculty in some of these areas where faculty never had any authority, but they have not protected some of the things that we have been accustomed to. So there has been this kind of a cutback. Now, of course, another sort of an effect has been the creation of a very large central administration that's on top of the whole works. This is almost entirely new. We had nothing very much like this. There was a coordinating committee of higher education that was over the former state university system. And of course, we had an administration that covered Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, Kenosha, and the center system and extension. So we had a kind of a six unit, a little merged system before. But nothing in the kind of an organization we now develop, where we have a a central guiding authority for all kinds of university affairs. This has meant a very
and the actual universities.
Fred Harrington was a former professor of history. He knew a great many people on the Madison campus. I guess I would say he probably knew as many as anybody you'd ever know. I mean, very much aware and very closely identified with Madison, knew everything about it, knew the courses, knew all these things. We've now developed an administration in Van Nuys that has no faculty, has no students, it has no courses, offers no courses, it doesn't have anything, and they're very remotely associated with their with all of these things. One of the things that sort of impressed me, back in the rioting days, one time I was up talking to my old friend Bob Clodius, who was vice president. And there was something going on below. The school buses pulled up and the policemen were piling out. I don't know if they were the sheriff's men or city police or what, but the armed, the policemen were appearing, and there were obviously people running around. And Bob and I were standing there looking down at all this and wondering what it was all about. And you'd see these little ants running around down there and the school buses, and we knew something was going on. And we speculated about it, and we all the gossip and everything we'd heard, listened to the radio and all that, and asked what, and Bob, we both wondered what was going on. I couldn't stand it after a while, so I left Bob and I went down to find out. Well, now that's the level at which we all operated on the campus right down there. We come in contact with students, and we do have faculties that we deal with, and faculty people we know, and that sort of thing. And this is a very remote thing at the top there. There's no connection. Do you know that John Weaver never once spoke to the faculty at Madison? Never once addressed them? Now this may be wrong, and maybe you're going to have to correct my facts on it. He made one effort, and this was a meeting that got disrupted, and he never came back.
I was going to bring that up as the one exception that I was familiar with.
This was, I think, in 1970, and there was a meeting at which John Weaver was supposed to come in and speak. And it was a meeting that, for various reasons, ran into trouble. It was in troubled times, or still the connected with the Vietnam War, but something had happened not long before that had stirred up people, and everybody was quite excited. So the times were not propitious, and the way we staged it was not very good. The meeting was to be held in, I think it's room 3650 in the Humanities Building, and the room was full of students, and we could not get the students really out, so that we managed to get enough room in there to bring in the senators to have their meeting, but there were a lot of students there to begin with, and we started off with a kind of a condition of disorder. It began, that meeting began with a member of the Senate, I suppose, who I, member of the History Department, I guess, offered a motion to suspend the regular order of business and discuss the Vietnam War, and the Chancellor, Ed Young, presiding, declared that was out of order, and it was by any of our rules. You don't put these the agenda is set before you get there, and you don't bring these things in. But that kind of set the tone. It was not long before John Weaver got up to talk, and he talked for about three or four sentences. It seemed, anyway, a very short time, and there was noise from the audience. It was the kind of noise that you get when you got a whole room full of students, and I don't recall anything in particular, like cat calls or anything of that, but somebody's always talking and all this sort of thing. And Mr. Weaver turned to the Chancellor and said, "Mr. Chancellor, in my judgment, this meeting cannot continue." So Ed Young got up and he adjourned the meeting like that.
But there wasn't any obvious outbreak or interruption?
Well, I think everybody thought that Mr. Weaver gave up too quick. Watching somebody, an old hand like Ed Young, in a disorderly situation, is kind of an experience. And Mr. Weaver never learned any of that. He never had that kind of experience, and never knew how to cope with it. What Ed Young would do in a thing like that, in a condition like that, was to continue. He would continue in spite of the interruptions, and the interruption may get more pronounced. It may be a meeting that everybody knows from the beginning cannot continue. See, it's going to be disrupted one way or another. But Ed Young would persist. He would persist to the point where the people who were friendly to him would say, well, now why doesn't Ed quit this thing? Why didn't he adjourn the meeting and so on? But Ed Young would continue on until he was almost the last man out the door, you see. He would continue on till it was obvious to anybody who was there there was no possibility of continuing. But he'd done his part, you see. He'd made his effort. He'd done all this sort of thing. And he would have gotten as much sympathy as you probably could get out of that kind of a situation long. And then he would dismiss it. Well, Mr. Weaver took a look at the hostile faces, which we were surrounded with in those days all the time. I mean, these situations were always bound to develop, or likely to develop, under almost any circumstances. And you accept it as a matter of course. John Weaver, though, looked at him once, and he quit, and he never came back. As far as I know, he never addressed the Madison faculty. He was scared of them, I think. Afraid that they didn't approve of him. I don't know if this went back to the original selection, but the faculty has never been very strong for John Weaver, and I think part of it has been his failure to get in and mix it up a little bit. I spoke of Pat Lucy coming to talk to the faculty. John Weaver was much more, his public positions were much more on the side of the faculty in this sort of a thing than Pat Lucy's were. But who came out to talk to the faculty? The governor did. He came in there, and to some extent I don't know whether he swayed anybody to his viewpoint, but at least he impressed people with it. Well, there was a point there, and he was a fellow of some courage and conviction, and he was willing to come out and talk to us and field some questions and things like that. Mr. Weaver was always absent. Well, I can't really blame him in a sense, because I think he had no experience, and of course he never did have any faculty contacts. He's always been, and this I'm talking here about that funny relationship between a central administration and the university that you get when you have a merged system. He's always been one who liked to deal with the faculty in a kind of long-handled fashion. We've laughed sometimes and said, what he really wants is somebody that he likes who can speak for the whole faculty, and then he will talk to him. And he has talked to two or three members of our faculty, I think.
Such as?
David Fellman. Dave is a well-known person, always been heavily involved with faculty, but I think Dave deals with the faculty as something, I mean, as a bygone generation. I don't think the faculty is like Dave thinks they are anymore, and so on. But he's the way the faculty ought to be, I'll say that. I mean, I'm sympathetic to him, but I don't think Dave is a guy who can give... could give John Weaver the real flavor of what was going on. Well, the central administration eventually was successful in setting up I think they asked the university committee at one time to provide them with two or three people to talk to them, you see, as to represent the faculty, and then they set up what is kind of a council now. I've forgotten the exact title, but it's one which are representatives from all of these many institutions, one apiece or something like that, and one person from Madison with two votes or something of that sort. That's the kind of contact they like to have with the faculty, and which is quite against our tradition. In our tradition, nobody speaks for the faculty, and in any case, one person doesn't speak for the faculty and so on. So this is what they need. A very loose, a very remote and not very realistic connection with the faculty. I'd like to go back to this Weaver fiasco. that, oh, that particular meeting, because that was one that was of great interest to me personally. It was mismanaged, and I guess as secretary of the faculty, when since I set up the meetings and all that sort of stuff, I would be responsible for the mismanagement. I mean, we did it the way we had been doing them in the past, but it didn't work out this time. It was mismanaged because there was a large class in that room the hour before the faculty senate meeting was supposed to begin. Now we have our meetings, we have them in a different place, but we have our meetings, and I have the room sewed up. It's empty the hour before the meeting is scheduled to begin. That gives us time to set up our equipment, like our PA systems and our taping and other things, and get our furniture arranged. But it also means the room is empty, and so when the time comes, you can admit people. You admit the senators, and they go down and sit in the voting section where they're supposed to be, and you admit other people and so on. But you have some control over it. We don't start with a room that's already full of students.
You have an orderly arrangement instead.
So what happened on this occasion, we went down. Everybody, I got down there early, as usual, and people were waiting around outside because there was a class in progress in there. And it was, you see, this is a pretty good sized group. We have 225 senators, and there are usually a lot of other people, and particularly when it's said that the president's going to speak, you see a lot of people would come. So there are a lot of people waiting outside, and we were looking at the clocks anxiously. We had to get in there and get the stage set up and all those things. So we watched this, and the lecturer just kept on and on and on. The bell rings. There's a 15-minute interval between classes. The bell rings, and then you're supposed to terminate your class, and then people are supposed to clear out, and other people come in. Well, the bell rang, and no signs that the lecturer was going to discontinue.
Mm-hmm.
I went into the back of the classroom. It's a big hall. Ralph Hansen, the director of protection and security, who was the university's number one man in dealing with disorders, you know, at the time. Oh, yeah. Ralph and I went in there and stood in the entryway where we could see what was going on, and the room was just jam-packed with students. This was Harvey Goldberg's class. Very popular speaker. Very interesting man. Popular speaker and very popular with the students, and he always had overflow classes. Well, this was one of his overflow classes. I don't know the subject. I suppose I could go back to find out what the class was supposed to be about, but he was up at the head of the room, and he was lecturing, and these students were around, and you never saw such a lecture hall in your life, or at least I haven't, even though Harvey used to lecture out in Ag Hall, where I could see an Ag auditorium. You see, he had big student bodies. I mean, when he'd offer a course, it'd be of a big registration, so he'd have to have the biggest halls to take care of him. I used to see them out there, and they were, in the view of the Ag people in Ag College, they were pretty disorderly classes, but big and enthusiastic. Well, Ralph and I came in and surveyed this thing. The students not only had all the seats filled, but they were sitting in all the aisles around, and you sit on the floor in the aisles, and they were draped all around, and it was quite a group. Now I kind of think of it as being one where they would sit in little groups and smoke and maybe have their pets with them and things like that, but it was a pretty informal group and very crowded and everything like that. Well, Harvey showed no signs of stopping. We looked at our watches, and we said, finally, we talked about how long can we go before we have to move them out. I mean, that would be Ralph's phrase, do something about it anyway. And we sort of decided, he said, do you want me to do it? And I said, no, I guess it's my job. So what I did was make my way from the back of this crowded hall down to the speaker's platform, way down below. And to do that, I had to climb over students, you see, because all the aisles and everything were closed. So it was a long way down there, I'll tell you. And I got down there, and I stood beside the platform there. Harvey was up speaking. And he was apparently oblivious of me, unaware that I was there. Now, maybe he was, but I've always strongly suspected he knew all about it. He was waiting for this. I'm accusing him here, I guess, of something.
Would he have known about the meeting that was coming?
Oh, yeah, sure he would. Well, you see, everybody knows that when your allotted time is over with, you're supposed to quit and release the students because they're presumably going to go some other place and all that sort of thing. So he kept on, and I've forgotten what the, but I mean, we must have given him 10 minutes out of the 15 minutes in between the thing, which is almost unheard of. Anyway, he noticed me, and then I asked him if he would, if he'd quit, because we had to have the room for the Senate meeting and so on. Well, he looked very startled, and he stopped in mid-sentence, and he picked up his, as though he didn't quite cringe, as though I'd hit him or anything like that. I was standing down below him and speaking up to him, but he picked all his papers up and stuffed them in the bag, and he left. And of course, the students hissed and jeered and so on. I mean, I was the bad guy. Yeah, I was sure a tough one. Well, those students, you see, were the ones who were in the hall before we tried to start the meeting, and it was the meeting was very much delayed, because if people don't want to leave, you can't very well get them out of there. I mean, sure you can, but it's kind of a passive resistance, you know, and we had all kinds of people recruited trying to move the students out so we'd have enough place even for the senators to sit. And also, this meeting had got quite a lot of publicity, and there were some flyers, as there were in those days, on almost all occasions, literature distributed saying, attend the Senate meeting, and I don't know, I can't remember exactly what but the idea was that they should attend and participate and find out what the faculty's doing and find out what the president is doing and all that sort of thing. So I don't think this was altogether a surprise that we had a little trouble getting this in the meeting.
Well, quite presumably some of those members of Harvey Goldberg's class intended to stay for the meeting.
Yeah, it would be incorrect of me to say that I think Harvey knew exactly what he was doing and this was sort of a plan, but it's at least conceivable and it would not be entirely out of character. Harvey was one of the faculty members was considered sort of radical, and he was always taking the role of the students and so on when some of the other people weren't.
Well, he's been active in the teach-ins, I think.
Several years before. Very good speaker. I have heard him speak on a number of occasions in faculty meetings, for instance, and very good, very good. I didn't agree with what he was saying, but I mean, he was a heck of a lot more exciting than some of the people I did agree with. Well, anyway, one of the things that I say, this was a personal interest to me. Sometime later, and it couldn't have been more than a week or so afterwards, in my office, I was visited by Morton Rothstein. Morton was then chairman of the Department of History, an old friend of mine. And Mort came in. He was kind of embarrassed by it all, but he, in a very sober, formal way, announced that he was delivering to me a resolution adopted by the history faculty. In there, one of their departmental meetings, a resolution censoring me as secretary of the faculty for disrupting the lecture of Harvey Goldberg.
Oh my goodness!
And this this was something of a surprise. And it takes time to collect the thoughts, of course, on that. We did talk for a while. I mean. I never did see a copy of this resolution, and I've often thought I should go back to the history department and see whether they had one, because I was should be entitled to a copy of it anyway.
I would think.
But we did talk about it, and I satisfied myself that this was an action taken by the history department, the faculty of the history department, and I'm sure there were people who I was told. There were people who opposed it, but the majority anyway prevailed, and they passed this thing without doing any investigating or anything of the sort. And what they had was Harvey's word and the word of two or three other members of the history department who were probably including this fellow who could not get his Vietnam War resolution on the agenda and so on. Well, this ended up, and I told Mort, Mort, you take that back, and if I hear any more about it, I'm gonna sue your department. We had a we had just set up a committee on faculty rights and responsibilities, and one of the functions of this committee was that it was supposed to protect faculty members who were unjust or who feel they're unjustly accused by, well, we were talking mainly about people who were accused by legislators and downtown folks of being radical and so on. There ought to be some kind of a mechanism in which faculty people can have a hearing about these kinds of allegations.
Sure.
And so on.
Sure.
So I says, if I hear any more about this, I'm going to take you right in front of this committee. I'm going to charge you and bring you in and insist on a hearing and get this thing straightened out. I told Mort enough about what had happened and Ralph Hansen had been right there, and Ralph was one of my witnesses, but we had a lot of other people too. So Ed Young was so mad about this, he was very mad about this whole thing. He wanted to make an issue of this sort of thing. So we kind of quieted down. I don't know whatever happened to it. I suppose Mort went back, and it may have been that the history department satisfied itself by adopting a resolution of censure, and that was that. So nothing much else happened. Anyway, that was the meeting. This was really talking about merger and its effect on the faculty, the role of the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
The central administration being remote like this, also with a board of regents, half or more of which had no particular allegiance to Madison. Which, see, once we had our own board of regents, and now we have a board that not really specifically responsible for us
not a bit. There were 27 different institutions involved all over the state.
And that was a different sort of board too. You see, our board of regents were all more or less concentrated on Madison and Milwaukee and these other two schools, but they were pretty well identified with us in the whole board. Now, the other board of regents, my impression is that they had individually a kind of an interest in the institutions within their own bailiwick somehow. That is, you would have a regent who was very interested in the University of Platteville, and who would, as I recall, that was an example, but in any case, a regent who was very much interested in who was hired there and quite actively involved in the actual administration of that thing.
That was a very good example, because it was Roy Kopp who was head of the state board at that time.
Well, they had these areas of considerable personal influence as individuals on that board. So and when you got it, when you got the combined board, you had the feeling, we had the feeling, that we didn't even know who the regents were, let alone have any real knowledge of them. Now that board, quite understandably, coming from a different kind of, I'm speaking of the other regents, the outside regents back in the days when merger was adopted, they came from a different kind of tradition altogether, and so it's not at all surprising that the different ways of doing things. This Board of Regents is apt to take actions without asking the faculty. So these things come to us after the regents have acted on things that we have always felt were a very considerable part of our own sphere of interests and responsibilities, like admissions policy. If we are concerned about having too many students, well, the regents jumped in the act with this enrollment limitation sort of a policy without ever talking about the faculty. So we had a couple of two or three meetings devoted to that. I don't think that we have influenced anything very much, but we thought that at least if the regents are going to limit enrollment at Madison, we should have the responsibility for deciding how it's to be limited, not to make the limitation by rules that the regents might adopt.
Are you saying that they set limits for specific campuses and not just general rules for the whole system?
Yeah, I think that's so. Now, I think part of the picture here is we had Madison and a few others that were oversubscribed, and we had schools without enough students and with empty dormitories and things of that sort. Schools that were in very serious financial problems because they didn't have enough students. And I think one of the things the Regents had in mind, that if we set limits on Madison, their argument was that this would force students to go to Whitewater, for instance, where they needed the students more than we did. And of course, many of us poo-pooed that, because they said if they don't go to the University of Madison, the one we're talking about is the University of Wisconsin, they don't go to Whitewater, they go to some other comparable school, which would be in another state. But anyway, things of this sort, I think the present Regents now do without really thinking about it, or if they think about it, they dismiss the thought that the faculty ought to be consulted before they do it. And I think it's a very good reason, because it was only at Madison where the faculty had to be consulted beforehand, you see, and so mm-hmm. we've been left out on some of those things. Now, I said that there were certain manifestations, like the right of a department to pick its people and the choice of high administrative officers from the faculty. Those things really haven't changed, but it's been more or less undocumented matters of tradition and habit and custom to bring the faculty in, to consult with the faculty ahead of time, to take faculty recommendations, and to solicit the advice, guidance of the faculty in running the university. Those things are the ones that have sort of taken the beating. Well, there's no way out of merger now. I think it was a bad idea, but maybe it's the only way that we could run a very large educational system in the state. Maybe this is sort of inevitable, but it's part of the tendency to centralize and to organize in a very cost-efficient way, supposedly, educational system.
Well, there was some general feeling that the coordinating committee wasn't a total success also.
Well, I think that's probably so. I mean, what they were really thinking about was something that would really centralize it, give you more control. It was touted to begin with as a way of saving money, and I have not heard that argument for a long time, because all we can see is an enormous central administrative structure set up in addition to anything we ever had before, in addition to anything the state ever had before. To begin with, I think both because he may have felt that way, but at least it was expedient, the president and a general statements coming out of, I suppose, out of the Regents, at least out of central administration, were in the direction of giving as much autonomy as possible to the local campus, to the Madison campus, you see, and to the campuses of these others.
What happened to that?
Well, what happened first was that actually they cleared out central administration, because this was a kind of a suspect place. They didn't clear it out too much. Madison, they quit furnishing services, basically.
You're talking about the central administration for the Madison, for the original University of Wisconsin.
I guess what I'm saying, thinking of the central administration under Harrington and the central administration under Weaver. Under Harrington, a lot of things that were done over in Van Hise were really done for the separate universities. We would have all of them were done in one place. It grew out of Madison. Actually, what this was the Madison administration that sort of expanded and took over responsibilities for Milwaukee and the other institutions. So in a sense, it was ours. Most of them our own organization, people we had put in the jobs and so on, just developed and taking care of the others. Well, under Weaver, when the local autonomy thing was first talked about, They canceled some of these services and said that from now on the individual campuses were going to do it. First place, you had acquired a good many more universities, you see, so you could not really extend these to other places. And so what Madison had to do was build up its own administration. Madison acquired quite a few people from a central administration. A delicate problem there, because what you want to do is acquire the people that you want, but you don't want to take the ones that you think are no good, you see. So, so it was a kind of a pick and choose or an effort there. But Madison built up its own administration and, in effect, to take over some of the things that Central had previously been doing for us. Mm-hmm. And then about that time, we got into the Weaver administration got into trouble with the legislature, and particularly with the governor, for not knowing, for not administering, and so on. Now, so they were really forced into the business of administering, and the way you administer, of course, is to build up a big staff and get enough people to do the administering, and they have to make their jobs. To do their jobs, they have to have information, so they ask for an enormous amount of administrative information that had never been furnished before, which takes an awful lot of manpower just to fill out their reports that kept coming out all the time. And then, of course, when you get all these things, then you got all this information, and then you think, well, I ought to manage using this information. So in a way, you cannot avoid, if you have a central administration, taking away authority from the local campus and exercising it at the top, as well as building up an enormous manpower. Mm. For quite a long time, when we were cutting down on the number of people on the Madison campus because of the budget, the only positions that were open were good ones, and they were all in central administration. They were advertising for vice presidents, you know, and things like that. And of course, any time you get a vice president, well, then he has to have a staff. So this is the place you get hired. Well, that may be enough on this question of what the effect of central merger and the central administration has been. But this has not been a happy relationship. I would say that Madison has never liked the central administration, and they've always been a good deal of trouble to central. One of the problems for central administration, because we probably were less tractable in being administered this way. More fighting for to maintain its own independence. It'll be interesting to see what happens now.
That occurred to me, since you've already said that at some point, I recall, that in certain instances, Young was more interested in retaining this role of faculty governance than the faculty themselves. What will he do as president of the system?
Well, I guess that may be one of those things we have to wait and find out. Ed Young was always very much aware of the faculty, and he was always very strong in keeping the faculty in the role. I think in a way, and I don't mean this in a derogatory sense, he used the faculty as part of his administrative decision-making structure. A decision to be made, and if you can get the faculty to make it, if the results are approximately are the ones that you really want, why turn it over to the faculty. I mean, I think he would use them in that sense. I think he also prides himself with justification in being pretty adept at handling these kinds of situations, working with faculty and achieving some kind of workable results, you see, by working with them. So he has been fairly comfortable, I would think, with the faculty on the Madison campus. Now, what happens when he gets into central administration, I don't know. He's now got a different sort of a job. It's an unpopular position from the standard view on this campus. You know, you don't like the president of the system as well as you like the chancellor of your own institution. And you don't like to be combined with all these other people, you see, that are also members of the faculty. We're outnumbered, Madison. A constant thorn in the side of the Madison faculty has been the fact that there are so many other faculty people in the whole system now. And the views of our faculty, which we have always thought were very much worth taking and being solicitous of, get pretty well submerged, if heard at all. The relations between Madison and these other institutions is kind of difficult to evaluate, but I don't think it has been altogether friendly. Madison has always been accused of being an elitist the elitist establishment, and the plain fact is the Madison campus is the one that has had a world reputation, a national reputation, and so on, and nobody ever heard of these other institutions, although they all have their local pride and so on. We have the faculty organization that's called TULF, the Association of University of Wisconsin Faculties, does not include Madison, you see. So, and TULF is the one that has gotten a lot of the publicity. They organized, it's kind of a pre-union stage of development. They have organized, they've got subscribers, they've got members, I think, in all the other institutions, most of the other institutions. And they have representatives, paid representatives who are in the news quite a bit. And the newspapers don't really observe these technicalities. They talk about somebody speaking for the faculty. Well, they're talking to the faculty of the system, and it's somebody not speaking for us, and very particularly, in many cases, representing things we don't believe in. This has been difficult to take care of. It's always a difficult role, I suppose, to be a member of or representative of the best institution, and one where there's a great variety in these things. You know, you run for cover when you're accused of being elitist and putting yourself above everybody else. You deny all this, you know, because this has been the this isn't a democratic way or a polite way to do it, to say that the institution is a different kind or anything like that.
But in fact, they think it is.
Yeah, I mean, there's no getting around it. And you get caught both ways. If you say we're not any different, well, then you end up and do what Pat Lucy says. You pay your professors who teach introductory French, you pay them the same at all the institutions, you see. If you can't survive that way. As a matter of fact, wages, you see, I haven't student of this very much, but everything I have seen has indicated that there's been a constant tendency to equalize the wages around here. And it makes a difference because at Madison, when you go out to hire a faculty member, you go on the national market. You go to some of the best institutions and you find out who their best candidates were, and you hire the best young PhD out of Berkeley that you can get, and you have to pay him more than if you're hiring somebody who from Madison who doesn't have any other jobs. We used to provide a lot of our PhDs to some of these former these other institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't always our best ones, or we didn't think so. Now maybe we were wrong. I'm using very using elitist standards here and so on, but I think that just the difference between whether you are a nationally, internationally known institution and the kind of salaries you have to pay to get and keep that kind of faculty is one of the things that you simply have to preserve, unless you're going to get in this deadening equalizing thing. Or in the case of the teacher, I don't know anything about instructing in French, so this isn't a good example, but it's one thing to hire somebody to teach and have him teach out of the textbook, you know, read the textbook and have cool classes with the students. I mean, this is the kind of the high school sort of approach. Or hire somebody who wrote the textbook in the first place. The authority. Well, these have been very hard for us to handle. Maybe I should drop this merger thing, although it's going to be very interesting to watch Ed Young in this role, because he's got a different position now, and I don't think it's possible for him to forget really what he got in there, the ideas he went in with, but I don't know how he's going to accommodate those with to other pressures on him.
Well, so far, all I recall is that he has gone on record as saying that he's for developing the peculiar, qualities of the different individuals.
Well, that's a good principle, and it's a good way to put it, and so on. Now, we don't know what that means when you get down to nitty-gritty. Madison was always very hard to handle for central administration. And I have been told that people working in central administration are delighted to have Ed now as their president, because now they think they have some kind of control over Madison that was never we would argue against things that were decided by central administration, and I think in some cases would basically refuse to do it. And Ed was pretty good in this. And there were some very, very strong statements that came out of Madison about central administration and how silly some of their ideas were and how impossible it was or how costly and how unessential and things of this sort.
Well, it can work either way. We'll have to see.
This is kind of interesting, incidentally, because Irv Shane and Ed Young used to both do this, except that Irv Shane and Ed played the good guy, bad guy combination pretty much. Ed was more the conciliatory man, more easy to get along with, but Irv Shane was pretty blunt. I mean, he would sound off a good deal on these things, and I think what Irv said in many cases was what Ed was thinking, but he let Irv take the bad guy role. Now, what's going to happen now when you? If you should get Irv in as a chancellor, it'd be an interesting thing to watch.
Certainly would.
Well, maybe to drop this Senate, or to drop the central administration and merger thing, and get on to another topic that I think ought to be talked about, that's the formation of the Senate, University Senate. Now, maybe nobody else in the university thinks of the Senate as one of the things that has led to the decline of faculty authority. And certainly even I would say I don't know what would have happened if we hadn't had the Senate. But the fact is that our system of faculty government, and I mentioned this the other day, was a kind of a, sometimes referred to as a town hall system, in which you have a faculty of maybe 2,400 people, every one of whom was a voting member, every one of whom could attend faculty meetings and debate, but more than that, could make motions, could get up and amend things, could vote on these, all these things. You see, you have this enormous membership of a faculty meeting. And of course, you never had faculty meetings like that. Your faculty meetings, as a matter of fact, the old faculty meetings that we had, as far back as I can check the records, averaged in size about the size of the Senate meetings. Except. In the years of disorder when we had these enormous meetings.
Well, Mark Ingram has described it. The earlier exceptions were when decisions like were we going to the Rose Bowl or not.
Oh, yeah.
But he has described it, I think, very well as a self-selected Senate.
Yeah, that's it was a membership for these Senate meetings, for the faculty meetings. It was a membership that depended on what the business was for the day. We had a rule saying that basically nothing that was not on the agenda could be discussed at the meeting. So you just so you could tell what was going to be talked about at the meeting, and you'd go or not go depending on your interests. Well, this system of government, which as far as I know worked very well, I guess there always have been people who thought we ought to have some kind of a Senate. I don't know, I never was aware of any move for it. But when we got in the years of disorder and we had these enormous meetings, obviously these were no good from the viewpoint of a viable legislative organization. I mean, you can't have 1,200 people acting as members of a legislature, you see, and have any kind of order out of it. I never thought this was really the the importance of those meetings. I thought that the importance of those meetings was to get together and talk about things you're concerned and make your points and make speeches and so on. Now, let off steam, you see. Now, of course, we did legislate, and we did observe some rules of order, and it was a situation in which some people talked a lot more than others did. Everybody was pretty unhappy with it. They were disorderly, and they were not neat and efficient meetings and so on. Well, this encouraged people who